So do you have the votes to pass health reform, Congressman Clyburn?
No, we don't have them as of this morning, but we've been working this thing all weekend. We'll be working it going into the week. I'm also very confident that we'll get this done.
House Democratic Whip James Clyburn on Meet the Press yesterday morning. Will that answer change by the Democrats' self-imposed deadline of this Sunday? And folks, this week is it. I mean, I don't like sports metaphors for politics, as many of you know. I usually think they trivialize into games these big, important things with profound implications for human beings that politics is really about. But this week is the Political World Series, Wimbledon, the Stanley Cup, Kentucky Derby, Frazier Ali, and Kasparov versus Deep Blue, all rolled into one. And at least I use some unusual sports metaphors. And of course, it is March Madness, total insanity, in fact, as the political world goes. And that's a high bar. The content of the bills is set, so for the moment, it is all about winning or losing. And it will be about strategy. This is part of the game that the managers might actually win or lose for the team. So to help us grasp some of what might take place and to comment on one of those things in particular, or two really, is Tom DeLuca, Fordham University political science professor and co-author of Liars, Cheaters, Evildoers, Demonization, and the End of Civil Debate in American Politics. He also had a piece in the Christian Science Monitor this month arguing that a filibuster against the health reform bill would actually be unconstitutional. Professor DeLuca, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian.
This would actually be at least a two-part process, wouldn't it? Because reconciliation doesn't cover the whole health reform bill.
That's right. First, the House would have to basically vote to agree to the Senate bill that was already passed by a 60-vote majority. Then I believe it goes to the president for signature, and then they do the reconciliation process.
And we'll talk about this more later in the week with some other guests. But some House Democrats were hoping the Senate would go first because they don't trust the Senate to not break some promises on the second bill. Can that even happen?
It sure could happen. If the Senate doesn't actually agree to the reconciliation the House does, then the original bill will stand and the House will have signed on to the Senate bill. I mean, the framers did build this kind of separation of powers between these two branches. And unfortunately, there is a lot of distrust sometimes, particularly on the House side.
And so when you say, so the House will have signed on to the Senate bill, is that the thing I've been hearing? And some people are really upset about this, that there's a way that the House could not actually cast a vote for the Senate bill, but somehow substitute a measure declaring that they have already voted on it. Do you understand that at all?
No, I don't. And by the way, that's one of the problems with this, Brian. The more arcane all of this gets, the more it really hurts our democracy in the sense. I mean, if we who follow the news can't really keep up with exactly all of these various maneuvers, how can citizens who have other things to do?
That's a really good point. And it is our job to do it. And we will be keeping up with these maneuvers and following this closely all week. If there were to be a filibuster, how would it start and when?
Well, basically now you don't actually even filibuster. I mean, Mr. Smith's goes to Washington's filibuster is old news. Basically, the new rule adopted in 1975, which reduced the need for a cloture vote to 60 votes rather than the old two-thirds majority, also said basically that you don't actually have to get up and talk anymore. You just inform the majority leader that you have the votes to keep a filibuster going, and you don't really have to do much of anything.
So, listeners, our phones are open for anything on filibustering, reconciliation, or any other of the procedural maneuvers that we may see this week in the health reform bill endgame. Call us up, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. You can call pro, con, explaining a question for Fordham political science professor Tom DeLuca, 212-433-WNYC. And we will do this in one form or another all week because I can't say it enough. This week is it on the health reform bill, 212-433-9692. Or, of course, you can always post to our website, WNYC.org. click on Brian Lehrer Show. So why do you argue that the filibuster is unconstitutional? Do you really? I mean, you use that word in your article.
Yes, I do. I do think it is actually unconstitutional. And the reason I say that is because the framers are very conscious about those specific instances in which they believe supermajorities should rule. For example, amending the Constitution itself, or the ratification of treaties, things like that. So they kept it for very special purposes, and the filibuster was not one of them. The filibuster is really something that's developed in the Senate, and it's really accelerated in its use dramatically over the last 30 years, and it's accelerated even much more in the last 10 years.
Part of your argument goes back to the Federalist Papers and the founders' view of when supermajority should be required in general. What did the Federalist Papers say?
Well, here's what Alexander Hamilton, who was no liberal, said back in those days in Federalist Number 75. Talking about supermajorities as being the decision rule for quorums, he said, the history of political establishments in which the principle, this principle of supermajorities, has prevailed is a history of impotence, perplexity, and disorder. So Alexander Hamilton, who wanted a vigorous federal government, certainly was no fan of the filibuster. And James Madison in Federalist Number 10 basically promised us that the way we would stop minority factions from gaining a foothold and being able to hold sway in Congress would be by what he called the Republican principle. The Republican principle was an up or down majority vote. So I think the framers were very clear that they assumed in our major parliament, that is the Congress, that the majority vote principle would prevail.
So the filibuster itself is not in the Constitution.
Absolutely not. And it was it wasn't even something that was used very much in the 19th century. I mean, it was there, but it wasn't used much. And it really became institutionalized in the early 20th century. And but really what's dramatically changed is, I think, the deep partisan nature of politics recently, where the parties have realigned. You know, in the old days, we had the conservative Democrats and the liberal Republicans, conservative Democrats in the South, liberal Republicans in the North. But now the parties are far more polarized. So the filibuster becomes a kind of tactic of choice by which to not just to delay and encourage debate on legislation, but actually to stop legislation. In other words, to kill bills. And this, even in the last Congress, for example, I think it was used something like 140 times, the idea of trying to attain cloture. So what we've got here is a change in quantity turning into a change in quality. In other words, it's used so much today that it's really become the routine of how you defeat legislation.
Staying with the history, you also wrote in your article that the filibuster upends the Great Compromise of 1787, which, for those of you who, you know, maybe it's been a few months since your American history class, that's the thing that gave us a bicameral legislature, a House and a Senate.
That's right.
And what does the filibuster have to do with that?
Well, the filibuster, for one thing, it gives the minority of senators an extra constitutional veto both over the majority of senators. So, in other words, their votes become relatively worth more than other senators. That itself violates the equality of states principle in the Constitution. But then it also gives, in a sense, this minority of senators a veto over the entire House of Representatives. And that goes against the idea, you know, those states that had large populations believed that representation should be based on population. In those days, states like Virginia. So the filibuster gives, in other words, the Senate, minority senators, extra clout over majority senators, and it gives minority senators much extra clout over the entire House of Representatives.
Does all of this, people's points of view on this, depend on the politics of the moment? I don't know your personal politics, really, but gosh, wasn't it just a few years ago when President Bush was in office and the Republicans had the majority in the Senate that the Democrats were using the filibuster to block some very conservative judicial appointments? And the Republicans were saying, this is a country founded on minority rule. The filibuster was never intended to block judicial nominees, only for other things. But it was the Democrats and liberals who were standing up and saying, no, minority factions need to have some representation. We can't have tyranny of the 51% majority in America. And now it seems like everybody's all scrambled and arguing the opposite.
I think you're right, and I think they're both wrong. I mean, that's the problem. In fact, there was an op-ed that George Mitchell, the old majority leader of the Senate, wrote in the New York Times back then, basically complaining, just as you're saying, we have this long tradition of protecting the minority in the Senate, and now the Republicans want to destroy that. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right that there's been a lot of hypocrisy on this issue on both sides.
Sam in Newark, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling. Hi, Sam. Sam, are you there? We will try to get back to Sam in Newark and start with Nick in Edison instead. Hi, Nick. You're on WNYC. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you. Listen, just calling to say that I think what we need is clarity. We need to know exactly what the bill is. Then it would almost eliminate the need for all this posturing on either side. We need, like last week, you were doing something interesting about the problems New York was going to have.
Yes.
And how people, you know, so that was very interesting. We need these things itemized and set up clearly so people can make clear-cut decisions and know what they're signing and backing or not backing. And then we, as the voters, would be served better. The greater good would be served by clarity.
Now, can you does clarity to you, because the Republicans use this a lot against the Democrats, they say, oh, this 2,400-page bill, 2,700-page bill, whatever it is, one of the Republicans brought one to that meeting with President Obama the other day, and Obama called it a cheap stunt, a prop. Do you think you can do a health care bill that really takes care of everything that it needs to take care of? In a simple way, or is it our responsibility as citizens maybe to get our heads around some complexity when the issue is complex?
Absolutely. It's a complex issue. All the more need for clarity. And I don't mean bogus clarity. I mean if there's like some real central issues that could be served, that everyone could be served better by. We deserve the best plan possible. I want it. We all want it. I think everybody wants it. The majority of people want it. But it's how it's delivered. And that, in the long run, would serve the better good by taking the time it needs and offering more options.
Nick, thank you.
More possibilities. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Call us again. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Tom DeLuca, Fordham political science professor, as we talk about the filibuster and other machinations that are possible this week in the health reform bill endgame. Marianne in Manhattan. Marianne, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Okay.
My question is, what is reconciliation for this bill?
What is it? How does it work?
Yeah.
Tom?
Well, it's basically an effort through the budgetary process, really, to try to reconcile differences between what the House members want and what the Senate members want.
Is that why they will need two separate bills? Because not all of these things, like the abortion restrictions, for example, can be deemed budget items, and so they could not be placed in a reconciliation measure?
Yes, that's the problem. But again, this all comes back to the filibuster, Brian, because it's the filibuster that the reason we're having this reconciliation process is largely because since the Senate already passed with 60 votes one bill, the only process that can be followed now is for the House to pass that same bill. That's why you have to go to this arcane reconciliation process instead of having them re-vote by a simple majority rule on a new bill.
And Marianne, we'll continue to look at the details of reconciliation during all this week as it comes close to actually being used. So you say, you go so far as to say in your article that if someone starts a filibuster or tries to, Vice President Biden, presiding over the Senate, should rule it out of order. How would he do that?
Just as you just did, say I rule it out of order. Basically, what's happened here, we forget that the filibuster is not in the Constitution, but the vice president, as president of the Senate, is in the Constitution. In my opinion, the Constitution assumes a majority rule in both houses of Congress, and so I think on that basic principle, and for the reasons I mentioned before, I think there's a very good argument for him to rule the filibuster unconstitutional.
He could do that unilaterally, you believe? Wouldn't the Senate have to change its own rules first?
No, I don't think it would have to. Now, what would happen is there would be what's called an appeal from the chair. Somebody would challenge that, and then somebody would move to table that appeal, somebody who supported Biden. And that tabling of the appeal would be voted on without any debate because it's a motion to table, and it would be an up or down majority vote.
Huh.
And by the way, if the vice president was upheld on that, that in effect would become a new rule of the Senate. It would set a precedent.
Who would have to uphold him? A court?
No, the Senate itself. I mean, they would uphold him in a vote. In other words, somebody Biden would rule it unconstitutional. The somebody would obviously object to that, and then the senators would table that objection. Now, then the Senate would vote on whether or not to accept tabling that ruling that appeal of Biden's ruling.
But somebody would take Biden to court, right?
Well, the. probably what would happen is the Senate wouldn't agree with Biden. I mean, I don't think because I think there are enough Democrats and Republicans that want to protect the filibuster that I don't think Biden would be supported on that.
Right. And then we'd have to go from sports metaphors to World War III metaphors.
Exactly.
Nuclear options.
That would really be the nuclear
like
option. Right.
Bob on Staten Island with a question about the filibuster. Hi, Bob.
Yes. A lot of people are saying they should actually force the minority to go onto the floor and actually do a filibuster instead of this gentleman's agreement that they don't do it. But if a filibuster actually occurs, it puts more pressure on the majority because they have to maintain a quorum and they have to keep 50 members on the floor to hear the one person speaking. And right now, senators spend so much time fundraising, they don't want to be on the floor of the Senate, actually.
How about that? Make them actually filibuster. Stand up and, you know, who's going to listen to Mitch McConnell talk on for 72 hours in a row?
I always thought it'd be interesting to have clips of young Jimmy Stewart filibustering on the Senate floor juxtaposed with Mitch McConnell. This is the rule that was changed back in 1975, Brian, where you no longer actually had to get up on the floor to speak. You could basically notify the majority leader that there was enough votes to keep a filibuster going, and that's when they reduced the filibuster from two-thirds to overturn cloture, to have cloture to down to the 60 votes we now have. So this itself is a Senate rule that would have to be changed.
So it used to be two-thirds? In other words, you would only need like 33 or 34 senators.
That's right, to keep a filibuster going. But again, I want to stress that filibusters are not used. I mean, there are some very famous ones like the Strom Thurmond filibustering against the Civil Rights Act of 1964, things like that, very famous ones. But it was not used nearly to the degree it's used today. And really, the basis of my argument that the filibuster is unconstitutional is not that it's unconstitutional in principle. It would be fine as a delaying tactic. But if it becomes the normal, the new normal on how you defeat legislation, in my view, that clearly violates the Constitution.
Here is another political science professor who also wants to talk about that rule, I think. Gregory in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. I was just calling in because your guest is getting some things wrong about the filibuster. I've written a book on the filibuster and studied a lot about the history of the filibuster. And the 1975 rule did not create silent filibusters. All the 1975 rule did was it reduced the cloture threshold to three-fifths. The silent filibuster is a practice that has emerged over time, basically because the majority doesn't want to deal with the minority taking the floor and filibustering. The Senate's agenda is so packed, and they have so much on their plates that they can't afford to let the minority take the floor and hold it for extended periods of time. They just wouldn't be able to get anything done. So there are. The silent filibuster is not a rule that needs to be changed. It's a Senate practice that needs to be changed. But as the caller from Staten Island rightly pointed out, it's just the case that the majority doesn't want to have to deal with it because their agenda would be wrecked as a result.
Well, how do they change the practice? I'm a little unclear on the difference that, you know, the distinction that you're drawing between a rule and a practice.
Well, a lot of people point to the multi-tracking system that evolved in the Senate in the early 70s, where basically you put a bill on a track, and if it gets filibustered, then you leave it on that track, but you move to another bill. So that bill is still under consideration, but you don't have it on the floor at the given time. You're able to move on to other bills that are on these other tracks.
But Gregory, doesn't that go back to the that same period around 1975 when they made that compromise on the 60-vote threshold for cloture?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the earlier.
Didn't those two things go together, essentially? In other words, when they put it on the two-track system, goes back to about that same time, they made that rule change.
Well, I mean, I think this is more a symptom than a cause, because basically you have a lot of factors that are coming together that lead the Senate to not want to deal with filibusters in the way that they dealt with them prior to the 1970s. You still, after the 1975 rules change, you still have senators who are taking the floor and holding it for extended periods of time. That practice gradually goes away as the Senate's agenda becomes as crowded as it is today, and as senators' personal schedules become SOPAC in terms of traveling back to their states. You know, there used to be a thing in the Senate or in the Congress generally called the Tuesday to Thursday Club, which basically was members of Congress who only were in D.C. from Tuesday to Thursday, and then the rest of the time they were back in their districts. Mm-hmm. That was usually members who were from the Northeast and could get back to their states or districts relatively easily. Now every member of Congress is a member of the Tuesday to Thursday Club because they all go back to their states. They all go back to their districts because it's, in their view, it's so important for them to interact with their constituents and also
and to fundraise
and get involved in fundraising. Yeah. Exactly.
Gregory, thank you very much. Tom DeLuca, we're going to run out of time here in a minute. One of the other things that's going on this week is that with the help of outside interest groups, millions of dollars are being spent this week alone advertising in the districts of these various swing members. It relates to what you and Gregory were just talking about. You have a coalition of insurance companies and U.S. Chamber of Commerce employers on the anti-side, pharmaceutical companies, unions, and others on the pro side, spending millions on these commercials, and others trying to get people to call their undecided reps. Locally, by the way, listeners, no matter what side of this you're on, we have John Adler of New Jersey in Burlington and Ocean counties, Scott Murphy of New York and Kirsten Gillibrand's old district in the Hudson Valley and up around Albany on these lists of key undecided Democrats. We had Elliot Engel, Democrat from the Bronx in Westchester and Rockland last week on this show saying he is still undecided unless they fix some of the ways that he feels New York gets hurt in the bill. He may vote no. You have even staunch liberal Dennis Kucinich of Cleveland, a no vote because he thinks the bill doesn't go far enough and they're trying to convert him to yes. So I don't know. Tom, can anyone whip Dennis Kucinich?
No, I don't think anybody can. But, you know, this is, as you know, of course, a major, major issue for the Obama administration and for the Democrats. So there's going to be enormous pressure. I think Dennis might withstand that pressure, but there's going to be enormous pressure to vote for this bill among the Democrats. It's a historic vote that they'll be taking.
And we'll talk about that later in the week as well. The whipping process, maybe that's where the political Kentucky Derby metaphor comes back into play. Of course, all the Republicans will vote no. They are all pre-whipped. This is it. This is the end game this week. They're looking for that vote on the health reform measure by the end of the week, and we'll talk about it all this week. We want to thank Tom DeLuca, professor of political science at Fordham University and co-author of what's your book title again?
Liars, Cheaters, Evildoers, Demonization and the End of Civil Debate in American Politics.
We're certainly seeing that today. And he also had an article in the Christian Science Monitor this month arguing that the filibuster is unconstitutional. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Coming up next, WNYC's Bob Henley and New York Law Journal editor Chris Fisher on the law and politics of the settlement with 9/11 responders and the appointment of retired Chief Judge Judith Kaye to investigate Governor Patterson. And then don't forget, we're still collecting your weekend freaky storm stories on our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show and your names for that storm. But stay with us for Bob Henley and Chris Fisher.